with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
And we're going to need to be, considering how little time we have left and how bad the world is crumbling all around us. Hello, guys. Hi, Larry. Hi, JB. How are you guys?
Doing good.
I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good to have all of you part of the chat room. I guess, Larry, that after finding your Paleo-Hebrew Pauline proposing pontificator, you ran into, and that's a tough one right there. Somebody who claims that they're Torah observant and yet they believe Paul. they don't quite understand, do not add anything to it, and yet that's all Paul did, or subtract anything from it, and Paul did that as well. And then you went from there to a former judge who was an atheist and thought that old predictions were irrelevant because they're old.
Yeah, prophecy, in other words. He did, of course, he had no understanding of anything. He even told me, you know, I basically, it was on a post about, you know, Islam raising hell over in Dearborn, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know, you might be surprised to know this was all predicted on a mountain high. You have arrogantly raised up and advocated your own bed and death buyer. And indeed, you have quickly become a witness for lifting up Allah, the perverse and unrighteous one, killing the living in the act of religious worship to gain favor with the deity. And I would say that's a pretty accurate description of Islam. Yet he said to me, well, Abraham was out sacrificing children. I said, oh, that's news to me. I said, I only study this stuff all the time. I said, can you show me where
child did Abraham sacrifice? Can you tell me? Can you just fill me in on which child he sacrificed? Or are you not smart enough to follow along in the text and to figure out that Yahweh was trying to convey a whole lot of very symbolic messages? No one got killed, and in the process, we learned that Abraham, like Yahweh, was willing to give that which was most dear to him to save the rest of us. That's quite a story, and yet no one was harmed in the filming of this episode. And we have a dress rehearsal for the fulfillment of Passover in year 4000 Yah, provided in year 2000 Yah, that has almost every element of the story. 3 days, journey, the Mount Moriah, the two witnesses on that came along but didn't go up all the way to the mount, the wooden altar that he was fastened upon, Yahweh providing the Passover lamb, riding even on the donkey to the location on Mount Moriah, bushes of thorns that caught the ram, like the crown of thorns on Yahusha's head. I mean, there must be 100 direct comparisons, making it prophetic.
He was knocking religion, and I said, you might be surprised to learn that Yahweh is more anti-religion than any atheist I ever met. They're, you know.
Correct.
And I pointed these things out, and in the end he says, I'm just not impressed. This isn't your work. You know, it's not right out of yada yada. I said,
so
well,
that makes it irrelevant?
Well, I said, so yeah.
I didn't disprove any of your, what you said, but. Well, you didn't do that yourself, so I'm just kidding.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know what I said to him? I said,
way,
I'm sure Yahweh
was
very impressed, that are very shook up that you're not impressed with his words. You know?
Yeah, you know, that would be, let's just say I was having a conversation with him, and he says, you know, these aren't, this isn't your work, so I'm not impressed with that. I said, well, okay, you're right, I just did the translations. It happens to be the creator gods of the universe's words. You're not impressed with him. I understand it. That's why you're an atheist.
Well, yeah, I just told him, I'm sure y'all was very shook up that you're not impressed with his words. You know,
yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure he's just he's probably crying at this very moment. You know, there is a reason that you're an atheist, and that is because you will not even consider the absolute proof that not only God exists, but that he has a name, he has a character, he has a plan, and you're just not willing to consider it. So that's
I've got to give you guys the ultimate here, though. He was knocking religion because of all the war, and I said, I got to tell you, if you're not impressed with Yahweh, I said, I'm not too impressed with the fact secular human has killed 100 million people in the last century. I said, now that's not impressive. You know, I mean, come on,
yeah.
Guys.
Oh, yeah, and by the
I said,
way,
you are a religious initiate.
Yeah. And said, you know, I'm worse than any of the false gods have done.
Yeah, now, by the way, Yahweh is also opposed to war. Yahweh is opposed to religion. To use religious war against Yahweh is indicates that you haven't been listening. And you're right. Beyond all of that, secular humanists have killed over 100 million people in the last 100 years. The most deadly scheme in all of human history is the scheme perpetrated by atheists.
And that is a religion. Secular humanism is a religion. I mean, sometimes I forget these guys are as big as boobs as the people that carry water for Paul, you know, or Muhammad. And
yes,
they're just as dangerous in the end. So,
right.
You know,
atheism takes as much faith, if not more faith, than any religion, if you actually examine the evidence, which most of them don't.
Correct.
And that's why they're atheist and not agnostic.
Yeah, one of, you know, my closest friend, Yoel, at one time was an atheist. He became an atheist because of the Roman Catholic Church. And he was sent to the Roman Catholic Church, for their catechism program and recognized all the stupidity of what they were saying. And so, when it came time for his confirmation, you know, he was asked questions, you know, do you, accept this, that, and the other thing? He says, well, no.
Nope.
And why should I? And he says, well, you know, if you don't, then we're going to expunge you from the church, and that means that your soul is going to die. He says, so you're telling me that,
sure,
that what you'll do is that if I don't acquiesce
so
that my thinking is the same as yours, then you're going to do an act which you are personally convinced is going to cause my soul to die. And so what you're telling me is you think I could express loyalty to an organization that is going to act to kill me. Now, why would I do that? And that was the end of the conversation. He was the mom was called in and said, you know, your son is going to hell. And the mom says, so you couldn't answer his questions, huh? Okay, can't answer his questions. He was too tough for you. You know, I'm happen to be in agreement. I think that it does take enormous faith to be an atheist, and he was an atheist, and he finally realized it was just way too much work, and it's much easier to be an agnostic, more rational to be an agnostic. I don't think it's possible to be a rational atheist, because what it means is that you cannot consider life. You can't fathom what happened before the Big Bang. You have to realize that it's science who has been wrong relative to the creation of the universe, and that it's Yahweh who has consistently been right. And so you put yourself in a position where then you can't consider the Cambrian explosion because it proves that macroevolution is a complete farce. And then you can't analyze DNA because there is a 0% possibility that DNA spontaneously, randomly came to exist.
Language,
it's a language. Languages always have an inventor and a purpose, a design. And so you're put in a situation where you have to lose sight of the big picture. And
well, can you imagine saying that prophecy doesn't count because it was written before? I mean, that's the very concept of prophecy. I mean, I was falling out at that point. I told him he was an irrational religious person and that his religion just happened to be that of secular humanism.
Yeah.
Nothing new about it, you know.
In my view, there's really only one way that God can prove his existence without eliminating choice as a viable option. Because he is so intelligent, so profound, so generous, so approachable, so just downright likable, so brilliant in his ability to communicate. If everyone was exposed to him, no one would be opposed to him. And so he can't stand up there in the sky and lay all this on us with a big booming voice, because he would be irresistible. Now, the other problem is that if Yahweh used miracles, if he intervened in human affairs to perform, you know, magic tricks to prove his existence, had his stood on the top of the tallest mountain and could be seen by everyone in the world at the same time, then again, you're in a position where he cannot be rejected. So the only tool that he really has to prove conclusively that he exists is to predict everything that's meaningful going to happen to his people, Yisrael, in the center of the world, at the intersection of the world, and then have everything that he commits to writing materialize exactly as he said it would. That really is, because if you are a rational and informed person, you can do the probability on that, and you come to realize that it proves conclusively that the author of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is a being that exists outside of the construct of time. But if you're not willing to consider that,
he says he's a being of light. I mean, he clearly says it. Then he is, because
Well, just think about him declaring that he is most like light, and then having a book where he says, "Prophecy shall be the proof that I have inspired these words," and for the next 2,500 years, mankind not understanding what he meant when he said light. I mean, because until really the middle part of the 20th century, mankind had no concept that on a photon of light, time simply exists, that you can see, witness the past, present, and future if you were like light. So here's God telling us something that is essential to our understanding of him. Light's eternal, and light is outside of the construct of time. And so he's telling us something about himself that we won't actually understand for 2,000 or 3,500 years.
I mean, sort of like the Big Bang.
Exactly. And so when he says these kinds of things that are so enlightening, then you have to say, all right, either it is God who knows more than humankind would know for 3,500 years, or that crazy sheep herder. Man, he was a smart dude.
He was mighty lucky.
He was either lucky or smart, man.
That's like Zach or Yah describing.
Everything in the Torah was relevant, 100% relevant to the people it was revealed to in the desert, and still 100% relevant to everyone who reads it today. Can you name another book that was relevant at the time, and every word of it is still relevant?
Of course not. But
no,
I would even go to say that during the time that Moshe was revealing the Torah, the furthest mankind had ever thought was that there were basic elements, and that that at the time God was the sun. At the time, God was the sun. And so this idea that God could be light, yeah, the sun's bright, but people had no idea that's the source of light. But think about it. Then even with the later, where they came up with this notion that there were the four basic elements, the earth, the wind, fire and water, that those were the four basic elements. No one even conceived that light was something special. And so for Yahweh to say, I'm more kin to light than anything else, 3,000 years before we would understand what that means, that's pretty powerful stuff.
Well, it's not relevant to this former judge because it was written, you know, more than a millennia ago. That it's not even relevant. Yeah, that's right. Even the Battle of Armageddon, which is set for a future time and talking about fast-flying war machines with drivers in them, that's not relevant. It's not impressive at all.
Well, if he's a judge, that means the Constitution, which was written, what, scarce 200-some years ago? It's not relevant to him either, so what makes you think something 3,000, 4,000 years ago?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, that he would fall into the scribe community, wouldn't he? And I think there were some choice words for those guys.
And the fact of the matter is that with someone like this fellow, the Constitution wouldn't be relevant. It was written a long time ago, and therefore it'd be his interpretation that would matter as a judge, not the intent of the writers. That's how he would use
himself. Well, that seems to be true. Yeah, sure. You're right.
There
was just an amazing thing to see somebody so irrational think that they were brilliant. And the guy's picture, I got to be honest with you, he looked like a silver-haired senator, you know.
Oh, yeah.
One of these guys.
Yeah, probably why he got elevated to judge. He looked the part.
Sure.
He couldn't think worth a darn, but he looked the part. It's sad how opposed we are to what God had to say. And JB, you did send an article that was a fellow reporting on a research project that had been done in a university where people were evaluated on their ability to think logically. And in this particular situation, they were initially, this large group of people was given asked a question about a healthcare product and its ability to remove a rash. And then they gave some data as to what the respondents experienced when they used that product. And it was asked, you know, was this product effective? And there's the charts, and if you're, you know, competent in sixth grade math, you could quickly evaluate the charted information that's provided, and you could give an answer that was consistent with the evidence and say, in this particular case, yes, the cream was effective. Now, that same group of people, and when they did that, more than 60% of those who were in this project could evaluate the chart and use the evidence to render a conclusion that was consistent with the evidence. 40%, even when it was a topic as simple as a cream and a rash, couldn't process the math. They didn't have math skills, which means if you don't have math skills, you don't understand probability. It's really hard to be rational. Now, they asked that same group of people now a different question, and this question was about gun control and whether or not that gun legislation had a tendency to reduce crime. And the charts were identical. They were the information and the conclusion of the chart was identical to the cream. No, was no more complicated, same information presented the same way, same obvious conclusion based upon a quick review of those charts, and you could render, based on the evidence that you were provided, an answer as to whether or not gun control would reduce crime. But because that was a political question, virtually 100%, almost every one of the participants answered the question based on their political bias and were completely uninfluenced by evidence. They had no intent even of looking at the evidence or of using reason to evaluate the evidence. And so what that test proved is that if something is political in nature, that people are incapable of examining evidence and being rational. Now, the inference would be that if you're, since politics and religion are very similar beats, that if a person is religious and you provide them with absolute proof that their religion is errant, they would be incapable of processing it.
I run into that all the time.
Yeah. It's extraordinarily common. Is this Will?
Yes, it is.
Hello, Will.
Oh, yeah, I run into this all the time, you know. I'm finding one thing about studying Yah's Torah more and more and understanding the Hebrew more, which is, I want to tell people, yeah, you got to put the time into it, but it's not really work. It's very relaxing. I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of truth is revealed to me, and I'm finding more and more that when the Spirit seems to move to talk to a certain person, and it's amazing, when you use His words, they listen. They genuinely listen, and I can be in public in a restaurant talking with somebody, and they can overhear it, and I go after religion. I'm sorry. I'm not going to apologize because God doesn't apologize for it. He hates religion. And I use words, and I don't get one person ever gets in my face to argue because I'm not arguing with religion.
I find a mixed bag when I do that. There are times when I will have those who are obviously in love with patriotism and the military and their religion will give me very mean looks and will try to look extraordinarily menacing, like, you can't speak against my religion, my country, my military in public without angering me and me wanting to, you know, put my fist down your throat. I get that. But I also find that when I have a conversation about the God's animosity towards religion and what He actually wants, that if you're having that conversation in a restaurant and other people can hear, that more often than not, people will just come up and say, can you tell me more?
Yeah, I've had that.
Yeah, so it goes both ways. What I have found is that Yahweh's words are compelling, but that they are only compelling among those who are open to listening to them.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I agree with that, too. I mean, I've met people in older generations, which are harder to get through. They're so steeped into their religion. They're so diseased. I hope they can change, but it doesn't seem that's possible.
Yeah, I think the older folks, and I'm an older folk, but the older folks are hard to reach because they're unwilling to even consider the evidence. And the younger folks are hard to reach because they've been indoctrinated with political correctness and therefore have a proclivity not to be rational. And what I mean by that is that if you can show that, for example, that God is opposed to religion, that still doesn't mean anything to them because they are into mutually conflicting ideas. I mean, they're willing to look at Islam, for example, as something that has merit, and not willing to evaluate it based upon the historical or scriptural evidence. And so, when somebody is indoctrinated in political correctness, while they might consider and they're willing to consider the evidence, they can't process the evidence rationally.
Yeah, basically
So there's a difficulty on both ends with folks, and I think that was by design. I think the purpose of political correctness as the national academic religion was specifically, with so much information available, the only way that you can effectively control people is to get them to be unwilling to think about it.
I know that when I was raised as a Southern Baptist down in Arkansas, we were taught the hellfire, you know, fear the Lord and all this garbage. But God loves everybody. And this is what I was told, the hypocrisy, the
Well, how is that possible? How can God love everybody when he's threatening those who don't respond to his love with endless torture?
I know. And the thing is now, but Yah has taught me so much about who he is, that he is very approachable. And I had one boss tell me, well, my God loves everybody. And this is what I was taught. And I would think, and I'd go, that's kind of funny. I guess he must have loved the Egyptian army and Pharaoh that was coming after Moshe to death. Killed him with kindness.
Loved him to death. Yeah, he must have loved those Babylonians, right? He must have loved those Romans, even though he said he despised them. As the Romans were killing his people and his promised land, must have just loved them to death.
Oh, well, God, the Christian deity is about a sometimes Santa Claus type of twisted deity that also, you know, tortures people relentlessly for all eternity. It's a very weird concept. I mean, this guy's more schizophrenic than, say, Superman. You know, it's really weird.
You got to see the Europe's version of Santa Claus. They're Saint Nick. It's scary. I show my grandkids this. They're showing demons banging bells and crap. If you're not good, this is what you get.
That's where it came from.
Really?
That's Saint nice. Old Nick. He was the devil.
Saint Nick is based upon Nike. It's the same god that the city of Nicaea was named after. It's the Greek god of victory. And so this idea of, like, the unconquerable sun, which was the religion of the Mithraism, that was the religion of the Roman legions, and in Greece it was Nike. They viewed that, allied with their god, that they were unconquerable. And so the Nicolaitans are those who view themselves as unconquerable. That would be today's humanist and secularist socialist, that man is the highest form of life, that he is essentially invincible. And so, you know, when you're dealing with Saint Nick, you're in trouble. That's, in fact, Yosha even said, one of the things that I like about the Ephesians was that they did not embrace the doctrines of the Nicolaitans, which would be those who had an affinity for man being invincible.
Yeah, and their influence, they're on TV, too, if you notice that, which is amazing. Influencing children, you know. So it just absolutely irritates me. I get so irritated with man's crap. It's just, I guess God's word does change you. When I first studying this, I felt anger, joy, sadness. I mean, just literally rage all in one shot. But that I was glad I found him. And the relationship has become more personal, and I get to know him more. And I'm not, don't have to be perfect. Holy crap, I'm an obstinate child sometimes. But he does correct, you know.
Yeah, I rather like that, too, that we are not asked to be perfect. We're not expected to be perfect. That would be,
no.
It would be such a burden if our lives had to be perfect. It would be so limiting if our lives had to be perfect. I think we would, in fact, if we had to be perfect, we'd become slaves to everything God said. And so I'm particularly pleased that the Torah is a liberating document, and that the way that Yahweh revealed for us to walk to him is freeing, that he paid the toll, that very little is required of us. We are, in this covenant relationship, we are the beneficiary. We get vastly more out of it than we contribute to it. And this instruction is all about emancipating us, freeing us, liberating us. I have a lot of people who write me and say, you know, I'm thrilled to be part of the covenant, to know Yahweh. I'm excited by the Torah. I'm learning every day. You know, I'm really frustrated that my wife or husband is so opposed to it. And, you know, I said, you know, what can I do? And I think the answer to that question is always the same. Study, come to know Yahweh, better and better come to understand why Christianity, for example, is false. Be prepared so when an opportunity arises, you have the right answer at the right moment. But more important than anything, continue to study, fall in love with Yahweh, come to embrace and be excited by everything that he has to say. And if there's any hope at all, it will happen because it's contagious.
One thing that I've come stand on the Sabbath is, or the feast, is that we come when we're invited because we're welcome, and mm-hmm. we meet and greet one another. And I wish I could find some work so I could be face to face and have a wonderful party and talk about this Sabbath and what it means. But it doesn't mean we can't. Hey, after this, we're contemplating His Word all day. Hey, take your grandchildren fishing. Talk about the Torah.
Right. Right.
And fish. God is family. He's not religious.
Right. William, where do you say you're talking to groups in hotels or something?
I'm around a lot of the Amish. And I looked at a lot of, you know, like religions do have truth in them, but of course it's twisted with halal's twisted message with man helping him along.
Right. Yeah, they're always painted. Yeah.
And they're
always counterfeits.
I look at them, they have it more closely right because of their community service to one another. They are so family oriented, but they still practice all the religious Babylonian things.
Most Amish and Mennonites both recognize the religion's a fraud. They know their elders are hypocrites. Most of them cling to it only because of the sense of community. And the pain of being ostracized from that community. But most Mennonites know that, as do Amish, know that the religion is absolutely BS. They just don't want...
like all religions.
They don't want to act upon that knowledge. I mean, the people are so corrupt in the Amish and Mennonite communities. They're so abusive in those communities. Even though there's this air of, you know, one for all, we're all going to serve together, we'll all work together, we'll all be so charming together, ultimately there is so much corruption in those communities so much just stupidity in those, so many rules, so, you know, it's just so many laws that most of the participants know that the religion is fraudulent, and they, as I say, they just go along because they don't want to be ostracized.
Well, that's one thing I was telling my wife. I said that we watch Amish programs and people who leave it or whatever too. And I said, see, they have so many rules, and I guarantee they all started with the rabbinical laws, the oral laws. That's where it comes from. And
yeah, they were Christians that wanted to create their own set of laws.
Yes.
Because it empowers the elders.
Yahweh's way is very easy to me. It's getting more easy all the time.
It is easy. It is simple. We haven't done this in a while, and I'd like to turn back to the 119th Psalm. Considering the 116th verse at the end of our program now, almost 3 weeks ago. And this particular statement in the midst of this psalm encapsulates the totality of what the covenant and the Torah and Yahweh represent. And Dod here says, I want you. This was written in the imperative. So the imperative has to convey either volition, in this case first-person volition, or it has to convey a command. And since Dod would never say, I command you to sustain and support me. I mean, that's just not consistent with anything that Dod has said or would say. I command you. And I demand. This is my commandment. I, Dod, have a commandment that you sustain and support me. So it's written in the imperative. And so you immediately have to say, no. It's not a command. So what is the imperative? There's two options with the imperative. Most of the time that it's used, it's an expression of first-person volition, or it's a command. In this case, this proves emphatically that it is more commonly indication of desire, of volition. So it's, I want you to sustain and support me. And then it goes on, in accordance with your promise. There are, Yahweh has a number of Hebrew terms to convey his testimony. Now, as we know, Bible isn't among them. Old Testament isn't among them. Scripture isn't among them. His words, his favorite, most common, is Dabar, which is just simply means communication, be written or oral communication. He very often uses Kafar, which would speak of written communication. He also uses Imra. And Imra is one of the Hebrew words for word, but it conveys also the idea of providing a promise, providing an instruction. So it's word influenced by, shaded by, the ideas of instruction, which provides a promise, a vow, an oath. And we also have all of the Hebrew words for enduring and restoring witness. Ed and Eduth are examples of that, where God will say that his testimony is restoring, his witness is eternal.
And it's his oath.
Yeah, so here we have, I want you to sustain and support me, but he's not saying, because I'm a swell guy. He doesn't say, I want you to sustain and support me because I've got a pure heart. He doesn't say, I want you to support and sustain me because I've obeyed everything that you've directed me to do. His idea of God and wanting God to sustain and support him is in accordance with his promises. And that is extraordinarily comforting for us. This is a guy that knew Yahweh better than any of us. And he knew his Torah and his promises in his Torah, understood them better than we do. And coming to understand what Yahweh was offering, he says, that's what I want. I want your support in accordance with that plan, with that promise, with the promise to do everything that he has conveyed in his covenant. To, you know, that based upon the terms and conditions of the covenant, if we embrace those, he wants the promised benefits of the covenant, which is where we receive our support. He recognizes in the Torah its presentation of the Moed Mikre, and thereby the benefits of us attending those parties. So he is saying, actually, I want your support. I want you to sustain me. I want you to uphold me, but not because of who I am, not because of what I've done. And he, you know, Dodo has a pretty decent resume. But instead, based on your promises. And that really is the only way that Yahweh can sustain or support anyone.
Because which one of us has a great heart? I mean, I know I fall so far short from him, it's not even me.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, there's aspects of all of our hearts that are exciting and pleasing to Yah. You know, we fall in love with him. We fall in love with his word. We our attitude, our perspective becomes closer and closer to being consistent with his. There's aspects of our heart, our desire to spend more time with him that he really likes. And the dark parts of our nature, of our inner nature, he doesn't see. He's blinded to, because he has covered us with a vessel of light that precludes him from even knowing those things exist. Then he says, and I want you to restore and renew me. You know, it's one thing to sustain and support, to uphold, but to restore and renew me, keeping me alive, nurturing me so that I will grow and enjoy these benefits. Chaya is very similar to Haya, the basis of Yahweh's name. It's just that the first letter, rather than being the He, is the Che. And so it's the hard H rather than the soft H. But it is interesting that the Hebrew word for life, for nurturing, for growing,
Che
is, and Chaya is extraordinarily similar to the Hebrew word that forms the basis of Yahweh's name. And that the Hebrew word chaya for life and restoration and growth is extremely similar to the Hebrew word haya, the verb, which means to exist, to be. And so Dode here says, not only do I want to be sustained and supported in accordance with your promises, I want you to restore and renew me, keeping me alive, nurturing me, so I will grow and enjoy these benefits. That is what the covenant is all about. We grow, we stay alive, we're nurtured, we're supported. So, he says, I do not want you to ever become ashamed of me or disapprove of me because of my breaching or breaking my ratification of the covenant. Now, in this particular case, the Masoretes were uncomfortable with the concept of peretz gal, which means to breach or break a covenant agreement. And because they knew that they themselves had welched on the covenant agreement, they replaced it.
They were guilty. Yeah.
Right. So the Masoretes replaced Peretz Gal with Sibir, which means my hope.
That's not even close.
No. So it went from, I don't want you to ever become ashamed of me or disapprove of me because of my breaching or breaking my ratification of the covenant. They changed it to, I don't want you to ever be ashamed or disapprove of me because of my hope.
That's drivel. That's drivel. That's like lions mauling my feet, if you will. You know,
right.
I mean, it's really bad news.
So, Dode recognizes that the promises that are associated with life, with restoration, with nurturing, with growth, with support, with being upheld, are all found in the covenant. And so long as we embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant, we receive all of them. That's the connection that he's making here. It's a profound statement. Now, it's drivel if you read it in an English translation of the Masoretic. But it's profound when you read it as it's conveyed in Hebrew and you render things like the imperative mood correctly.
You know, I was just about to point that out. I have a parallel version opened up where I compiled, and it has your translation, the King James, the New Living Translation, the I think I got the NIV in there, and the King James. Hold thou me up, and I shall be safe, and I will have respect unto thy statutes continually. That's what they managed to get out of it.
You holding me up is a reasonable rendering of kamak. Uphold, sustain, support, perpetuate my existence. All of those would be accurate renderings of kamak, but they, of course, chose to ignore the imperative mood.
Yeah.
All right, because Dode can't be issuing it as a command, and therefore it has to express a desire. Now, what was in accord with or consistent with Ka, that all makes sense. I don't have a problem with that. And then what was the rest of it? Support
and
me or
faith.
So they didn't talk about Imra. Imra, which is a promise, did they just ignore the word?
Yep. I'm not seeing it I'm not seeing anything that would translate that as that. It's hold thou me up, and I shall be safe, and I will have respect unto thy statutes continually.
Okay, so here the Hebrew word Imra, which means word, instruction, message, or promise, was ignored. The Hebrew word chaya, which means life, to provide life, to renew life, to restore life, to nurture life, and to grow, was rendered safe. I mean, there is no connection between chaya and safe. And then the idea that Boche, which was, I don't want you to be ashamed of me or disapprove of me, was altered so that it could be used in front of some form of what was the last sentence in there?
And I will have respect unto thy statutes continually.
Okay. Well, Dode is not asking God to respect him, but it is an expression of volition, Boche was, so it has to convey what Dode wants. It's in the it's the imperfect jussive. So it has to express what Dode wants. It's the hiphol imperfect jussive. It has to express that, and then men means because, and Peretz Gal is breaking or breaching of my ratification of the covenant. And the Masoretic would be Seber, my hope. I would assume that their translation of the end of that was taken out of the Latin Vulgate, which was ultimately a translation of the Greek Septuagint, and so that the Septuagint would have had an entirely different concept there. But that's that's the problem when you get far afield from the Hebrew.
I'm looking at the New Living Translation here, and it does a perfect job of conveying the Christian view of things. The New Living Translation says, "Sustain me, and I will be saved. Then I will meditate on your principles continually." Yeah, save me first, and then I'll look for you about what you have. That's the Christian mindset right there.
Yeah, as opposed to sustain me and support me in accord with, consistent with your promise. And I want you to restore and renew me, keeping me alive, nurturing me so that I grow. Dode's view is, I want to be sustained and supported, but in accordance with your Imra, your word, your promise. And then I want you to restore and renew me. Once you've upheld me, you know, I'm a child now in your family. Cause me to grow. Nurture me. Yeah, Dode's perspective here is the correct one, and the New Living Translation's perspective, of course, is the, as you said, the Christian view is, save me, and then I'll engage in a relationship with you, or I'll pay attention to what you have to say, so long as I can read Paul.
Yeah, let's make a deal.
Yeah, that's very, very different. Wow. Okay, well, moving to the next statement, we have... please, now I'm going to tell you this would be interesting to compare because there's so many different ways that you can render ka'ad here, and that's the first word. And ka'ad was written in the call imperative, which means it is expressing volition again, expressing a desire. Please restore, heal, strengthen, establish, and sustain me, ka'ad, because I want you to save me, yasha. I mean, there's no question as to what yasha means. I have chosen to genuinely lift up your clearly communicated and scribed prescriptions of what I should do in life to be cut into the relationship. Choke. Doing so continuously and consistently. Tamid. Throughout time. Without interruption.
Simple.
So it'd be interesting to see what they have to say about Psalm 119, 117, because ka'ad means to restore, to heal, to strengthen, to establish, and to sustain. It's written in the imperative, so it has to express Dode's desire for God to do that. And then it's got to be that in addition to that law, I want you to save me. I mean, yasha is just means salvation, to save. And then
actually, just looking at it, I think my finger slipped on the scroll wheel, and what I read you was 117.
Okay.
I was a verse ahead. My finger slipped down on the scroll wheel when I wasn't looking.
Well, you know, it's also true that various translations number things differently. So You know, yeah. I'm using a number 117 out of a particular, you know, out of an interlinear, for example, and it might be different in a different Bible. They all kind of have their own way of numbering.
Yeah, it's tricky when you try and look at and compare.
Right. Yeah, all the numbers do, like in Yada Yada, really all the numbers do is get you close, because there is no uniform consistency, and particularly in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms in the numbering. But it gets you close. So please restore, heal, and strengthen me. That's Ka'at. That's what it means, because I want you to save me. Also written, and this was written, by the way, I want you to save me, is written in the niphal stem, where the subject, dod, receives the benefit of the verb's action, which is salvation. Within the literal interpretation of the call stem, with the imperfect conjugation, which speaks of the continuing and ongoing benefits of being saved, but also in the cohortative, which is telling us that this is dod's choice. Hey, you have a choice here, speaking of choices. What you can do is to say, you know, I'm going to ignore that Hebrew has stems, that Hebrew has moods, and that Hebrew has conjugations. I'm going to ignore that. But if you do, then you're leaving a great deal of what was conveyed unconveyed. So, you know, somewhere along the line, I think it is our responsibility to consider what these verbs, how they were scribed, the niphal stem. And what that means, that dod is receiving, the speaker, the subject is receiving the benefit of the verb's action. Now, if you don't convey that, then what you're missing is the way this was written. And
but there are added benefits to not putting that in there too.
Of course.
Which means you get to copy edit and invent ideas that aren't real and everything else.
Right.
Okay.
But you have to, you know, when the cohortative is there, you need to convey that this is a desire, a request. So you've got to convey that if you want to be accurate. I have chosen to genuinely lift up. This is NASA. It is my heart's desire to literally and habitually carry with me, bear, and exalt. This is the call imperfect cohortative. Again, because it's the cohortative, you have to either convey to choose or to desire. The imperfect means it's ongoing. The call means this is genuine. So I have genuinely chosen to consistently lift up. And then it's your choke. Now, I understand that a lot of people want to render choke rules or regulations or edicts or, you know, there's a whole lot of things. But it's
principles and statutes.
Right, principles and statutes. Well, by the way, it's only one word there, principles and statutes. So it's only one word, choke. Now, I don't have a problem conveying a Hebrew word with lots of English words. But the key thing here is to understand that virtually every Hebrew noun of any import is defined by the verb upon which it is based. And if you do a superficial review of choke, you'll find, you know, statutes, for example. But then you'll find like there's six Hebrew words that are all conveyed statutes. And they're all completely different words. And so if you're thinking and you're doing your investigation and say, well, why would these things all be translated statutes if they're all entirely different words based upon different verbs? And the case with choke, if you scratch beneath the surface and if your mindset, if your perspective is, I have been conditioned in Hebrew to search for meaning on the action part of the verbal or action aspect of the noun. Now, an example would be kadash and kadosh, the speaking of renewal and what that means in terms of a month. You know, Yahweh's word for month is kodesh, And it's based on the verb kadash, and kadash means to renew. And therefore, if you look at the verbal root of the noun month, you recognize that a month begins when the light begins to renew on the moon's surface. You need to always, in Hebrew, if you want an accurate understanding, to look at the actionable part of the of that word, its verbal root. And in that light, keep in mind that in Hebrew, the nouns don't have conjugations. The nouns don't have moods. The nouns don't have stems. It's only the verbs that have these things. The verbs are all relational. The verbs convey volition. The verbs speak of that which is ongoing and habitual, or that which is limited in time, not the nouns. So it's the verbs which are enriched by these unique concepts. And in Hebrew, it's the verb which is exists throughout the fabric of time. It is not stuck in the ordinary flow of time. And this is a great example, choke. If you look at the verbal root, chuka, what you find is that the verbal root of choke conveys that which is cut, chiseled into stone, inscribed, etched. You know, when something is choke or chuka, then what it is it's the message is enduring. Rather than being written on a piece of parchment that where the ink fades in time and where the skin wears out over time, this is something that's etched in stone. This is something that will always remain viable, consistent. It's unchanging because it's cut into the stone. But chuka also speaks of cutting us into a relationship. So it's that which is cut into stone, inscribed, etched into stone, that which is therefore as a engraved or written, that cuts us into, and there's only one relationship discussed throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and that's the covenant. So it's cut
so us would into he be discussing those 77 words by chance? I mean,
yeah. So it is. It's this whole idea of: are you willing to go on the voyage of discovery, where the vessel is words, and where everything you're going to learn is going to be based upon analyzing words in your mind that Yahweh conveyed? And are you going to scratch beneath the surface? Are you going to actually, you know, this is, I've come upon a new island in the midst of this voyage of discovery, and the new island is choke. So are you going to simply take a quick look and say choke means statute and go on, and say, well, that's really interesting because there's like 8 words in Hebrew that are translated statute, and they're all completely different. Huh.
Well, one thing I really love about the Hebrew language is that Yah's words are so metaphorical. They paint beautiful, beautiful pictures, and the deeper you look into each, like I said, the verbs and all this and their roots, the more beautiful the painting becomes of what he's conveying to us.
Right. Etching in stone.
Yeah.
That inscribing, that conveys a sense of permanence, of dependability, and then being cut into the relationship conveys the same concept as karat beret, which is that Yahweh established, he cut, karat means to cut, the covenant. And so we're being cut into the relationship by that which was etched in stone, is the visual, symbolic meaning of choke. Or you could just call it a statute. But if it was a statute, why would you lift up a statute? Why would you celebrate saying that, you know, this is what I really want to do is I want to lift up the law, man. You know, you've laid down the law and I want to lift up the law. No. But saying that I choose that I, because it was written in the cohortative, imperfect, which means consistently choose, consistently desire, nasa, to lift up, it makes perfect sense that you would want to genuinely, consistently want to lift up that which was etched in stone and cuts us into the relationship. But it makes no sense if it's rendered statute. That'd be guy like the guy saying, man, I really love the law. I just love the law that says I can't speed. Man, come on. One is utterly moronic, and one is beautiful, sensible, rational. And I think that a lot of exploring, you come to this new island. The new island is Choke. And you realize that Choke is, there's a lot of action going on in the island of Choke, and it's communicated by the action form of the verb that comprises this island. And you think about it, you explore it, you circumnavigate it, you get in the midst of it, you gain a perspective on it, and all of a sudden, it's enlightening, it's beautiful, it's uplifting.
I like your analogy about love being the speed loss. Coming from a dad who drag race all the time, that does not fit my personality.
No, of course not. And this is something that Dode says, now, if it's a law, are you going to ever celebrate doing it consistently and continually, which is what Tamid means? Or when you're talking about something that is etched in stone, that is reliable, unchanging, and dependable, then speaking of it and your response being continual and consistent makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he found freedom in the law, apparently. Right?
Yeah, he did. Freedom.
Okay, yeah, freedom in the law.
Yeah. So,
well, I mean, that's what he says, if this is true. You know, I just am, it's shocking. It's truly shocking. How many people you can put through this, show them the words, show them what they mean, show them that there is no way in the world that that book you have named after the sun goddess Biblio is anywhere near accurate. Let's compare them side by side. I've done this 100 times.
Right.
And I've had people just say, oh, well.
Oh, well.
You know, so what they're reading isn't accurate, but they really don't care.
But you know In a way, I'm glad.
Yeah.
Because
since there's only
going
to be thousands standing in the end, I'd like to be one of them.
One of the reasons I'm glad is that what Yahweh is telling us is that man is superficial. Man doesn't like to have to work for knowledge. Doesn't want to have to take the risk of going out and exploring that new island. That's a new word. Once it's handed to him, doesn't want to invest the time or the energy in coming to know who he is or what the relationship is all about to explore that island. And so that in eternity, the only people that are going to make it to eternity are those people who says, not only am I interested in exploring that island, I can't wait to explore that island. Exploring that island of that word, Choke, is exciting to me. It's something I want to do. And rather than saying, oh, well, you know, I don't care. It says, I do care. I want to know. I can't wait to know. I can't wait to know. And so by having the English Bible translations be so inaccurate, so incomplete, it provides the opportunity for us to explore, for us to learn, for us to grow, for us to have fun in the relationship. That's the beauty of it. And there is a risk. I mean, there's a risk. I want to tell you, for example, I'm here telling you that based upon the verbal root, the Choke means that which is etched in stone, that which is cut, that which is inscribed, that cuts us into something. I'm telling you that's based upon the verbal root. That's what it means. Now, what I'm telling you here then is completely different than how Choke is defined in every Hebrew lexicon. And so I'm taking a risk. I'm hereby telling you that I think that the Hebrew lexicons are wrong and that the verbal root of the word is right. So, you know, there is a risk, but, you know, isn't every meaningful voyage of discovery have a risk? When the guys flew off to the moon, didn't they take a risk? When they flew, they started to sail around the world, didn't they take a risk? When you go on that camping trip and you're going to go off trail into a new area, aren't you taking a risk? And isn't taking the risk part of the enjoyment of the whole process?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, every time I go scuba diving, I'm taking a risk.
Absolutely. But I just
but
love
great.
It. Yeah, being down there and weightless and free and in a new environment and being exposed to such amazing forms of life.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. But there's if you take risk out of life, then I think you take the excitement out of life. There is an excitement of on this. And, you know, if somebody... Larry, if you or JB, if you were to do your own systematic evaluation of this word, choke. And choke's an important word. I spend a lot of time on it, but it's one of the four most important words in the 119th Psalm. And if you guys were to do a systematic study on it, you were to look up its verbal root, and you were to consider every time that it's used, and you were to come to a conclusion that it means something other than inscribed or to etch in stone. It means something other than to cut in. You know, I'm going to listen. You know, it's because of the fact that you know, the whole process of this discovery is that you invest the time, you figure out, okay, that's what the lay of this land is on this particular island of a word. And I'm going to run with that. I'm going to consistently use that until there is evidence that, you know, maybe there's more to it than that. And there probably is more to it than that. And rather than being defensive and saying, oh, how dare you question me, I'm going to say, thank goodness, you know, we learned something together.
Yeah, I'll say this, though. I've looked up choke a lot, and I haven't looked up every single use of it it has, but I've looked up a lot of them, and I've yet to come up with a definition that's consistent with what lexicons and dictionaries say and consistently fits in every use of the word other than this. So,
yeah.
Now, I may, you know, one day come up with something that fits better, but I don't think so.
You know, that was
not
my approach, too.
Not anytime soon, at least.
Yeah, that was, you know, there are two approaches to trying to understand words. Approach one is to look at the verbal root and to come to understand the actionable nature of the word. The second is to consider how the word is used, always considering the first use of the word, but then to consistently use the word in the manner that it is initially used and that's consistent with the verbal root, and to determine whether or not that works every time the word is used. And then there's
you can find a lot of times where it'll work here and it'll work there, but then you'll find two or three examples where it won't work. But then
right.
You have a definition that'll work in every single one. So which one's the more likely definition?
Correct.
That's simple.
Yeah, but then I think there is a third element, and that's why, you know, I'm willing to take the risk that this is the proper definition of choke, fully acknowledging that I'm a flawed and imperfect implement, no better than and no smarter than anybody else. I'm interested in doing this and interested in learning and interested in taking the risk. And that somebody may come up with a definition that's better. But my third test is the word in the context that it's used consistent with Yahweh's nature, his character, and his plan? And I want to tell you, this definition, it rocks. It's absolutely consistent with Yahweh's character, his plan, his testimony. And so when the verbal root and the consistent use is consistent with his nature and plan and testimony, then while it's still a risk, I become really comfortable and say, okay, you know, I may be wrong in the sense that I've missed something here, but I'm comfortable in saying, but I found something here.
That is a major flaw in nearly all translations, because they're busy trying to make, well, first of all, I don't even think they look at the words often. They certainly couldn't consider them because they add to them and then they leave them out. But I think beyond that, where we're at right here with Yahweh's character and nature is something that isn't even considered in nearly any translation.
And I want to tell you that while there are lots of people that know Hebrew better than I do, and there's lots of better grammarians than I am, and there's lots of people with greater intelligence than I have, and more knowledge than I have, I will tell you that one of the reasons that I'm typically comfortable with my translations, even if they could be improved, is that my perspective in creating them is, what is this consistent with Yahweh's character and his plan and his testimony? If it's inconsistent, I won't write it. If it is consistent, I'll convey it. I think that is the single most important aspect of all of this. So we were began in the chat room, and Larry, you were mentioning how this person ignored prophecy, where I view prophecy as the single most effective way to prove that Yahweh inspired these words, and therefore they're important for us. And I said, but, you know, I'm prejudiced. I tend to harmonize my perspective and my understanding so that it is consistent with Yahweh's. That's my predilection. And so I'm guilty of that. And I will tell you that every time I delve into translation, my overriding concern is to make certain that the words are rendered consistent with their meaning, but in a manner that is consistent with Yahweh's nature, his character, and his plan, and his overall testimony. I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
Well, that's not only a reasonable thing to do, that's what should always be done. And consistently, in religious material, it is not.
Yeah. I think it's also the humble approach.
Well,
the humble approach is, you know, I'm not trying to create my my testimony here. I'm trying to convey his thoughts here. So the only way to pull yourself out of it and to have him speak through it is to make certain that your renderings of these words are absolutely consistent with who he is and what he's saying.
Well, that was one of the things that was rather funny to me, that the guy said, "This isn't even your work." I said, "Well, no.
No, you know, Yahweh's work."
No kidding. You know, if anybody else pulled out a Bible and started thumping around with these ridiculous translations, that would never be said. You know, I mean, they would just take it at face value.
Of course.
But because somebody has really honestly worked to consider words, word by word, and tried to make an honest interpolation of what was being said.
Complete, accurate, but also open, you know, like to say, here's the word in Hebrew, here's the many shadings of what the word means, go look it up yourself, you know, if it's all right there.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, I've yet to see somebody lay out religious material that gives us a word by word what it says, and then in parentheses the word it comes from and what that word means. I've never seen it.
Right.
Other than the work that you share on, you know, Yada's Yada site. And so that's... it's shocking to me. I mean, as long as I laid it down and didn't have the words in there and no parentheses that you could check out, then it would be accepted, I guess. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's what they're saying.
Yeah, you know, in this particular statement as well, in the Masoretic text and in the Latin Vulgate, rather than Nasa, which means lift up, they have Sha'ah, which means I'm able to accept my reward, as opposed to NASA, I have chosen to lift up Yahweh's choke. And so they're very, very different concepts. and yet there's no attempt by the English translations to consider the oldest text. I do get a lot of letters, and they say, you know, when you talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, which one is it, and that sort of thing. And I always want to make people aware that I don't use the translations in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible. I think they aren't any better than anybody else's translations. In fact, they aren't even all that good. It's only
See commentaries that say, "And the Lord saith," and
right. So the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible translation is no better than any other translation. The only reason that I constantly refer to it and what can be learned from the Dead Sea Scrolls is that the book that is edited by Abeg Flint and Ulrich, called the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, that it has one capability, one asset that I think is extraordinarily helpful. And that is that you realize it, that with these scrolls you have, you don't just have one scroll of a book, and you know, many of them you have 60, 70, or 80 different scrolls of the book. And with the exception of the great Isaiah scroll, no scroll of any book is complete. And so you have all these fragments, and multiple fragments from multiple scrolls, and what these guys have done is some really heavy lifting. They have taken every one of those scrolls and every one of those fragments, and they have compared them to what's in the Masoretic. And then they show where the Masoretic and these scrolls differ. And that's really all I need, because so long as you know where the Dead Sea Scrolls differs from the Masoretic and what the difference is, then you're in a position to correct the text, to turn back time, to eliminate the copy edit. But that's all the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible is useful for, is giving you an insight as to what words were changed. Now, I think that's a powerful tool. But the other thing that you won't find in most translations is an honest assessment of the words. For example, if a word can have many meanings, it's important to have a discussion on that word. You know, ana is one of those great words where the word can mean to afflict. But that's not the primary definition. It's not even close. You know, the primary definition is to answer and respond. And so when you come up with a word like ana, it's vital that you're honest with the reader and say, this is the full palette of shadings and colors of this word. And so among these, some 24 potential definitions of ana, which is consistent with the way that it is being used here. And, you know, for example, with ana, what you find is that 90% of the time that ana is used, the only way to render it is to answer and respond. And there are very few places where ana is used that it means to afflict. But one of the things I love about Hebrew is that many words in Hebrew have a dark and light side. And they ought to, because everything is being conveyed to elicit a choice. Do you want to be cut into the relationship or cut out of the relationship? Do you want to be part of the covenant or excluded from the covenant? It's all about choice. So shouldn't words have choice embedded in them? So if you choose, for example, afflict, and anah, so that you afflict your soul on Yom Kippurim, then that is going to be your fate. Your soul will be abased. Yeah, it's going to be afflicted. You made your choice. And if you choose to answer and respond and come into the presence of the maternal aspect of Yahweh's light on Yom Kippurim, then you're going to be based in her light, his word. How you interpret the words, how you render the words based upon the full palette of definitions often describes the very consequence of that.
Well, ana, especially for Yom Kippurim, doesn't make any sense to afflict yourself. That would be an insult to Yah. It would be like what he did was not enough.
Yeah,
so you got to afflict yourself.
Yom Kippurim, what does that mean? I mean, what does Kippurim mean in Hebrew?
It's to reconcile.
Right.
And also, there's another one,
afflict.
Right. And
well.
So if you were, Larry, let's say that you and your wife were on the outs. Let's say that, heaven forbid, you did something really stupid. And you and your wife were on the outs. Would you reconcile
right.
your relationship by abasing yourself, by raping yourself, by harming yourself? Would that be a way that would get your wife to say, oh, wow, this guy is just beating himself to a pulp. That's just perfect. Okay, that's the guy.
Yeah.
That's the guy that I want to be with.
Yeah.
No,
are you
is this a rhetorical question?
No, that's not a rhetorical question. Of course it is. And that's why in the context – first of all, Yahweh is all about perfecting us and uplifting us and having us, adopting us into his family. You do not ask your children to harm themselves. I mean, that was so inconsistent with his character.
You wouldn't do that? Go
no,
harm
no.
yourself, child,
no,
and show me you love
my,
me.
You know, yeah, typically when I talk to my children, I said, okay, have you
whipped yourself? In the light socket. Go ahead.
Have you whipped yourself today? And if they say, no, I have not whipped myself today, then I say, well, then I'm not reconciling my relationship with you.
Yeah. Oh,
boy. So,
you know, the insanity of religion, you know.
Right. So there's
wild. You know, we ought to make
right.
it pay.
Right. The religion, the religious definition is not only inconsistent with the context of Kippurim, reconciliation, it's also in conflict with the Yahweh's nature, which is a loving and merciful father. And so if you have a choice, which you often do, to render something in a manner that's consistent or inconsistent, it's amazing that the religious publications almost universally prefer inconsistent.
Oh, they like the dark side.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You know, I mean, it's got to be this fearful experience of magic, no less. Everything's
right.
magical.
The
I mean,
the one thing about down south, they play with them, and they take that in what they call scripture that they're not God's going to protect them. Well, didn't Yahusha say you don't tempt him? I mean,
well, yeah, but you can test him, but you don't tempt him. By testing
yeah.
him, he actually wants us to test him, because why would he say, come, let us reason together? He wants us to test him. He wants us to test his words. He wants us to evaluate. He's pleased when we test him. You know, one of the great examples is that every time that I'm challenged by a passage, like, Larry, you've sent me a bazillion of these, where someone will say, but this statement over here is inconsistent with the idea that God doesn't want to be worshipped. And you go and you say, all right, I'm up to the challenge. Let's see. Did somebody actually find a place where God wants to be worshipped? And so you test it. And what you find is that the more you're willing to test God, the more enlightened you become. A great example I had of somebody that wrote me today was all concerned with trying to have Yahusha crucified on a Wednesday so that his body could be 3 days and three nights in a grave. And he said, you know, all these nights that I'm reading, you know, all of these scholars that I'm reading says that he had to be crucified on a Wednesday. Well,
yeah, did you ever consider cardia? The heart of the land is what, a cemetery? Are you kidding? You know,
Last time I checked, the heart of the land was Yisrael, it was Jerusalem because the land is Yisrael. But what you're saying is that because of your misunderstanding of that statement, you're willing to have Yahusha celebrate Passover dinner on a Tuesday night, which in 33 CE was 3 days before Passover? And then you're willing to have him become the Passover lamb, but not on Passover. He missed that by 3 days. And then you want to tell me that rather than having the Shabbaton of matzah fall on a natural Shabbat and the most important celebration of matzah in all of universal history, and that Yahweh is going to screw that up and it's not going to be a natural Shabbat, and that the firstborn children is not going to occur on the first day of the week, and that, oh, by the way, that when Daniel predicted that the Messiah would arrive in Jerusalem and the day happens to be 4 days before Passover, that really didn't occur? I mean,
what was his answer? I mean, you just put this in a real succinct order for him, besides the fact I'm sure you showed him the word used there was cardia, I would imagine.
Yeah.
First of all, the
person that wrote me the question was concerned and was trying to make sense of all of this. They had read An Intro to God. They had not read Yada Yada. And so they were trying. They were referencing these other sites and say, how do you resolve this conflict? And I shared with them things like, for example, the body could not have been 3 days and three nights in the grave because at Passover the body is destroyed, and that it's a misinterpretation of a bad translation of what Yosha said to religious.
It's
morals.
A religious tradition,
right? So we went through that, and I copied and pasted the specific chapter. I don't know if all of you know, but on each of the books, there is a search bar on each of the books. And so if you have a question, you want to know, was the passage translated, or do you ever speak of this? If you put it in that search bar, it'll take you to the places that concept has been discussed. For some reason,
I don't think that works anymore. With the latest version of the website, whenever you do a search, the only things that come up are from the forum.
The most recent search I did, I found that it only came up in the forum as well.
Since Yoel redid it, it's had that issue.
Yeah. In fact, would you send him a note? You've got his email, and let him know that is the case. And matter of fact,
yeah,
there's another
something
issue.
I've been meaning to do, and I just keep forgetting.
Yeah, another thing that we need to do too is that I was sent an email saying we're approaching the celebration of the Mikra, and the Teruah, and then followed by Kippurim and Sukkah, and so it's only 2 weeks off, and so I wanted to look up. I'm smart enough to look up at the sky right now. It's a full moon. So I know that it's 2 weeks off, so I don't really have to look at the site. But I noticed that when I went to the Mikra site, Yoel had always had the images of the moon phase that showed you when the moon was, had set, how much light was on it, and what percentage was renewing, and what time. Those links are all broken. So none of those links work at the moment. It's not life and death that he picked them, but they are really helpful because what they do is they put the reader, the searcher, in the position of having to figure it out for themselves, which is why I love the fact that Yoel put what the image of the moon that could be observed at that moment is, because it puts everyone in the position of answering their own question, which is the way I think.
Oh, by the way.
Yes.
By the way, since you brought it up, one of the most ridiculous things, and that's a particular sore subject with me, is one of the worst egregious translation errors in the Christian New Testament, that he was dead in a tomb 3 days, when the 3 days he was fulfilling were clearly the Moed Mikra. Those were the three important days. So he was working on those days. He wasn't laying around dead in a tomb.
Right.
And
he, from the time that he came back into Jerusalem to celebrate Passover dinner, which was on a Thursday night in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, from the time that he came back in town to celebrate the Pesach dinner, Thursday night, from that point to the point of the afternoon of Bukurim on the first day of the week, he did not leave town. He was both in the heart of the land, which is Jerusalem, and the heart of the earth, which is the metaphorical presence of Sheol. And so his soul, remained there for that period of time. And for the rabbis, he says, that's the only clue I'm going to give you, is that I'm going to be here for that period of time. And he did. He arrived on Pesach. And he did not depart until the afternoon of Bukurim, where he is described as being 60 stadia away, meeting with the two fellows on the road to Emmaus. But even before that's when he went to the Father. So he literally fulfilled that promise, but it's only understandable if you know what Pesach represents, what matzah represents, what Bukkudim represents, and how that whole timeline fits together. It's a stunningly powerful metaphor. But
do you think there's a chance that anyone who doesn't understand what Pesach, matzah, and Bukkudim represent, that they will even ever enter the covenant? Because
I would say no. No. And I would tell you that 100% of those who would say, who are trying to adjust the days of the week so that it ends on Sunday, and therefore is consistent with the Christian interpretation to him arriving on Wednesday, they have no appreciation for what Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim represent, or that Yosha's entire existence was to be the living embodiment of Yahweh, so that he could honor the promises associated with Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim, because they enable the promises of the covenant. The moment you understand how Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim, and then follow that by Shavuah, provide the benefits of the covenant, and that it is Yahweh's promise to us and his way to perfect us so that he can adopt us and make us immortal and perfect and empowered and enriched. The moment you come to understand that, any interpretation of any statement that is inconsistent with that, you would never articulate. And that's what I conveyed to this fellow. I said, somebody that will change the dates because of a parable and have Yosha's celebration of Pesach on the wrong day and having Yosha's fulfillment of matzah on the wrong day and not even consider that as relevant, you ought not be listening to. They ought not be speaking. I mean, that's really dangerous stuff when you do that. You know?
I think they call those people's teachers.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's a problem right there.
I know of a teacher, and I'm a learner.
Yeah, I do too. Why?
I'm a learner, and as a learner, I'm also a sharer, but I'm not a teacher.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be a learner, and I'm happy to be a sharer. But I don't want to be a teacher, because the moment you start to teach, then you get into the realm of, well, am I conveying my my own agenda here? And you don't want to do that, you know. And I think that there are lots of things that Yahweh says, like the example of Yonah, the 3 days and three nights in the heart of the land, that definitely require effort. That you're going to have to put some time in and to think it through as to why he said it that way and what it means and what actually happened. And so you've got to work at it. And also you've got to be really careful. You can't ever allow the Greek translation of the Hebrew conversations as they are recorded in the so-called Christian New Testament, which was absurdly copy-edited, it isn't even remotely reliable, supersede something that's in the Torah. When they're in conflict...
It's intentionally misleading. Forget
right.
reliable.
Right.
Let's just go right to the fact here.
When they are in conflict, you absolutely have to embrace the Torah and reject the conflict. I mean, that's just the bottom line. You know... During my exercise recently, I've been doing a lot of just superficial reading, not translating, just superficial reading, getting, a big picture of things, and it's just a nice way to spend the exercise time. And I was reading Matanya, which I enjoyed immensely, and then I read Mark, which I enjoyed less, but it was still okay. It was okay. And then I read Luke, and I just about puked. I mean, I couldn't even get to the end of it. It was so obvious that it was inconsistent with Matanyahu, who was an eyewitness, and that it was made up of hearsay, and that he got everything jumbled. But I couldn't endure it. It was painful. And even started to read Yao Kanan, and I dearly love Yao Kanan. I think Yao Kanan is going to be fun to get to know. But it's been so doctored and so convoluted over time, that what we have just is not reliable. And so I just shut it up and went right back to the Torah and said, I'm going to start at Baruch Sheath again. I'm going to read through the Torah. You know, I find that satisfying.
Well, I don't blame you. I mean, it's pretty sad what passes for Yahweh's words today. And, of course, they don't even use his name, so I guess they're not even saying they're some Lord God's name. And it's truly pathetic, very misleading. It's created atheists, I believe.
Yeah, oh, I agree. I agree.
It served to destroy billions, and that was its intent.
Yeah.
Just like eating halal food. You know?
Right. It's created faithful and atheists, both.
Yes. Exactly.
Because it makes no sense. You've got to cling to faith because there's no way that you could trust and rely on the nonsense that is conveyed. And there's so much nonsense that those who are rational and informed are going to reject it. It's just too bad they know that they don't know what they're rejecting is man's poison, man's copy at its band's just ridiculous statements as opposed to what God actually said.
You know, it really kind of takes a bizarre person to be comfortable in a religious setting.
It does.
There's something twisted about that.
Yeah,
I mean that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. But even more than that, there's something twisted about a deity that would want his creation to worship him. I mean, I think that is...
Oh, well, that's part of the whole religion problem.
Oh, but I know. But that's what really gets me. Imagine a creator creating a being for the express purpose to tell him how wonderful he is. I mean, it's just
he has some ego problems, you know.
Whoa.
Really,
and then how do you reconcile a deity that created humankind for the express purpose to tell him how wonderful he is, that in all of his first-person encounters with folks like Adam, does Adam ever say, boy, you are really wonderful? Does Noah, you know, in the personal engagement with Noah, did they ever say, boy, you're wonderful? When Abraham and Sarah are with God, we have all these discussions. We have all this. Do you ever hear
Abraham or Sarah saying they laughed at him.
You are just we honor you. You are just the bestest and the greatest. No.
No, I mean, that's the only thing who can kiss your ass the hardest didn't occur anywhere. And by the way, you know, if you've seen this ridiculous movie called Noah,
I did.
I rather like Russell Crowe as an actor, but I couldn't bring myself to see it. I thought it would make me too aggravated.
I didn't go to the theater. I actually came up with $4 and watched it on Affinity or whatever it was.
Oh, it's now on free on DirecTV, but I don't want the aggravation. I just. You know, the story of Noah and
everything rational.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I love about that story, and it's just never talked about, is why are there 4 men and 4 women, and why was anybody included other than Noah? I mean, Noah's the only person that Yahweh has a relationship with. So why were there men and 4 women? And why did Noah's relationship with Yahweh cause Yahweh to say, you know, we're going to bring your wife and your sons and their wives?
I think that would have probably been because he loved Noah. I mean, he knew Noah.
Right.
I think he knew that would break Noah's heart if it wasn't the case.
Right.
And I think that the reason that we're talking about four there is because of completion and also decision.
Correct.
And
correct.
Free will again.
Correct. Yeah. 4 men, 4 women. That's the four is everything you need to know about Yahweh's assessment of time is in 4 and 40s and 400s, and that linked with the Yobel is a brilliant way to assess time. All right, so you got that, and then you've got husbands and wives together. You know, Heavenly Father and Spiritual Mother, Abraham and Sarah. It's a precursor to the covenant. And the importance of family. It's a celebration of family. And then, of course, there are just so many other beautiful concepts, the upwelling of seawater and how man with a Nisama and all speaking one unified language became so effective at being evil. And God's concern over the whole story.
Can I bring something up here that goes back to religious tradition, which I find mythical and fairy tale like again? You and I certainly agree, and I'm sure everybody listening to this show, that the flood was regional. It was not worldwide.
Well, that's what God said.
Well, yeah.
And by the way, after eliminating everyone with a Nisama, Yahweh repopulated not only that region with the four of them, but he saw to it that humans with a Nisama were scattered around the world. So the whole story is presented as a regional story, and every proof that you could possibly have, the Black Sea going from fresh water to salt water at that very moment, and the Black Sea rising in depth by 500 feet at that moment, and the Black Sea at that very moment for the first time cutting a swath out through the Bosphorus Strait into the Mediterranean at that very moment, and at that very moment having 12 foot of silt that goes all the way up Mesopotamia. And at that very moment's when the Burkle impact crater occurred. Yeah.
Yeah, and these are all proofs, but I wanted to go back to the mythology here, the religious tradition. One of the things that strikes me, when you hear things that are just mythical and weird, you have to consider them as mythical and weird. And one of them is when they start talking about, and his black son. Now, you know, my thing here is that I'm married to, this is my second marriage. My first marriage, I was married to, you know, an American woman, a white American woman. Guess what color all four of my kids are, or what ethnicity, if you will. Take
Caucasian.
A shot.
Caucasian. Two Caucasians get together, they are Caucasian.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But mythically in religious stories, you have to try to add two things.
Yeah,
you've got to make things
yeah.
up. So there's got to be some magical.
Yeah.
His black son.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, now you got to look at the comedian Sinbad though too. He says his parents are black as black. Yeah, but he got everything besides the nappy.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
But
beyond that, Larry, in terms of the skin color in the black child from two Caucasians, is that they said that because they want to have a religious doctrine based upon it, when in fact skin color is absolutely irrelevant. Skin is irrelevant.
No,
the only relevant aspect we have one tiny relevant aspect of our skin. And that is the part of the skin that we boys ought not have anymore, circumcision.
Oh, yeah. That part, yes.
But other than that, there is no other relevant aspect to skin.
Yeah. I'm just talking about religious mythology.
Right.
You know, because they have to have all these races.
There's only one place.
Where did they have the Chinese child, I guess I should have said?
Yeah.
What about that?
Yeah, the one place, Yahweh, does take people to task for them being racist. And that is when Aaron and Miriam have a conniption fit with Moshe because Moshe's second wife was black. She was African.
That's right.
And so
they
had a conniption fit. And they were saying, you know, that he ought not do that. That's wrong. And what did Yahweh say? Well, you know, if you have such a fixation on white, I'm going to turn you Snow White.
Yeah,
you
have some leprosy here.
You just
white
love
as snow.
White. There you go. You got leprosy.
Exactly.
And he told Aaron,
I know what he
shut
did.
Shut the blankety blank up. He is my spokesperson. I love him. He does a wonderful job. I chose him, and I'm going to continue to work with him.
By the way, the Hebrews, the Black Hebrew movement,
yeah,
what they do there is, see, white is evil. White is evil. It's just the most insane thing.
Yeah, I know. I had a block
they
a lot
didn't
of
get
them
the whole point.
So you know what? Once has the opportunity to either speak on behalf of racism and the color of one's skin, or to speak against it. And on that one example, what did he do?
Comes out pretty strong there. You know,
right.
That's what I'd say.
Yeah. You know, when my son talks about dating, and occasionally he'll mention that he's going to date somebody that is Hispanic or someone that is Chinese, and once he one of the girls he met online was African American, and you know, just curious, he'll test me. He says, "What do you think?" And I said, "I think that skin color ought not matter." He says, "I knew you'd say that, and that's my view as well. It's character matters."
That's always been my view of it.
Yeah
doesn't Yah say he searches hearts and minds?
Yeah, absolutely. And by heart,
I don't. Look, the whole race thing I bring up is not about, hey, the white race. It's not about any such thing. It's about exposing ignorance in the mythology of the Black Hebrew racist, we hate you, whitey, movement.
Yeah. Besides that, besides that, you better be nice because I'm a Redskin. Although we Redskins don't call ourselves Redskins.
Yeah. Well, you know,
my kids are mostly Yank and Sioux. So.
Yeah. Mine. I'm Sioux Indian. Anyway, guys, I've got to run. My wife is in town. I promised I would take her to dinner, and my dog, who's not had dinner, is looking at me like you bum you. It's your job to feed me. And I'm going to go do both of those two things. Going to entertain the wife and feed the dog.
Very well.
Well, it's been enjoyable. I had a couple of good laughs there and gained some knowledge, but I had some good laughs. Really, I did.
I think it was a fun discussion. We talked general things and also specific into Yah's word. And you know, I love the analysis of choke. Have at it. Let's figure out what it means. Let's wrestle it to the ground. It's a fun process. All right, guys, I got to run.
Great. Have a
good
night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.